Okay, everyone, it's Mike J again, and we're here in R&D. Boy, are we in R&D. You ought to see the kitchen. It's a mess. But got a lot of things to get through today, so let me get started with that. I want to tell you what we're going to do in the Listen Light program, but that's not till next week, so I'll get my mind bent around this particular quote in the Call 5. You may not be interested in geopolitics, but geopolitics is interested in you. I thought that quote was very interesting. If you drop into mechanics, which is the first part of the call, I wrote, is that a yellow Volkswagen? And somebody said that there's some kind of thing in psychology where if somebody mentions something, that it puts it in your subconscious and that from then on you can start to see him, but before you can't see him. I always remember the story about the yellow Volkswagen, and nobody saw a yellow Volkswagen, and then once somebody said, "Look for a yellow Volkswagen," everybody saw one. Well, the reason I put that there is we really have to understand this whole concept of this paradigmatic shift that I'm suggesting, and I think that's where the big problem is. I've been suggesting it for a while, but I haven't been able to explain it very much. And that is, if you go back to the 30s, when Lehman Brothers analysts said, hey, we got to figure out how to get people to want more so that they will buy more so that we can grow. That was the big thing. 25% of people are unemployed. We're facing that same cycle again, by the way. So if you think UBI was important, just wait till we get to this next cycle, which is coming now. The point being is that the paradigmatic shift that we're all going to have to look at is what is good for us in terms of things that we can do in terms of our attention. And I think that's going to be so key. I put an example here. I love this. They say the best con is where part of the con is an accepted truth, and then the rest can be made up as a con. In other words, as a confidence play. That's the same thing that Rules for Radical said. And I mentioned that a few calls ago, that what if we looked at Rules for Radical and we took the things out of there that were working and we left the other things that weren't working and didn't have to become so radical, but used the things that worked. And the thing that works is narrative. In narrative, the idea is that part of it has to be an accepted, non-questionable truth. And then whatever else you put with it, you can spin it however you want. And so this example that I put here is a great example because all of us would say, yeah, the key to a happy and purposeful life is to invest deeply in things you know will never change while remaining adaptable and open-minded about the many aspects of evolving life. If the core of your identity is deeply rooted in thriving, then you might be able to enjoy seeing how things unfold in your lifetime. While change can be hard and disorienting, it also opens up new opportunities for those open to them. Most of my energy, and this is the author, most of my energy is directed towards seven areas I consider important, no matter how much the world changes around me. And then I put the link there where I got this. And then if you go over to that link, what you'll notice is there's seven fairly acceptable points of thing. The only problem is they apply to 5% of the people. So in other words, this is the whole game that's being played on us, is that you have to be very careful about what it is you agree to. Not only subconsciously, but in terms of consciously, with your what we were talking about earlier is the spotlight versus the floodlight. And if you look at all those seven anchors, which I did, which is why I pulled this article as an example, none of them have to do with saying, well, if you're like this, then this will be good. Because if you're not a person who is geared towards certain types of things, this won't be good for you. So in other words, It's an anchor. It's true. It's an anchor for stability in life. But the thing is, you won't be able to keep doing it. And unless it matches your motivation, then you won't be able to keep it up. So consciously, you'll focus, you go to class, you do the 21 habits, you do all these things, and you say, great. But then you notice over a period of time, it wanes. The reason it wanes is because your motivation energy is directed in another place. And so you've been taking energy from a particular pool that says, generally, this pool is available in terms of energy and information for everything. You know, we got to adapt, we got to do all those things, which the person says. At the same time, the pool does not get filled unless you're doing things that are directly aligned with who you are. And see, this is the paradigmatic shift. So they're using marketing and they're using all technology, certainly, to give us all these things, just like AI is giving us all these things. At the same time, it's not taking into consideration it, and it doesn't come with a warning that says, well, this may not pertain to you. This may be good just for 5%, because there's probably about 16 different types, and you could say there are more, because Reese, if you look at Reese's 16 desires, you'll see that there's one on each side. That's 32. So the virtues are 16, but the polarities are 32. But once you get out there, you get out too far to where on the tail of the bell curve, it's way out there in the 99.99, and therefore you're one of one. You know, which Reese says, everybody thinks, well, you get rated on these 16, so you're all being thrown into a box. No, that's not true, because if you do 16 factorial, I don't know if any of you are math people here, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of almost 2 trillion, I think. So the thing is that we're very different. And the fact that we're so similar, you know, everybody says, oh, 95% of your DNA is carried in chimpanzee. Yeah, but that other 5% is the differentiator. All you have to do is, I have this genetic service that I got involved with, I don't know, it's been 20 years ago when they were fledgling. And the guy, I think, is a Russian scientist. But they look at genetics and reports, and they send you all these reports, and it says, based on your gene SNP here and this, you'd be more inclined to be this. And it's just amazing, the genetic correlation. So in other words, we are, with that 5% that's different, is really different. And therefore, it makes us all kinds of things. So the thing is that the big thing for me, overarching in terms of mechanics, is that this paradigm shift that we are having to make as a generative thing. In other words, I'm trying to keep it generative, which I noticed this morning when I was doing some assumptions and beliefs about this work that we're trying to do. Because what happens is you have this big, broad, paradigmatic piece of work. Now you got to go in and give people the tools and the reasons to actually follow along and believe it. Okay. The DIS, or the Dynamic Inquiry System skills, are the bottom of the pyramid. It's flipped over, like we were talking earlier about flipping your life over. Well, skills are some of the last things that we think of. We think of all the theory, and we think of all the reasons and the assumptions, the beliefs, principles, and values, but we don't really ever get down to the skills. Well, we're turning it on its head and saying, wait a minute, let's learn these skills. And then once we have these skills, then let's apply all these things. And so that's part of what we're trying to get done in the book portion. Okay, so going back to the switchover between mechanic and book. I gave you a good lead-in. A good segue is we're finally out of the cul-de-sac, because what has been bothering me so much is to try to understand, look, I'm having to do this dynamic inquiry system skills, and I've wrote that 15 years ago, which means we've been using it for more than 25 years intuitively. Now, I have codified it, so if you're not intuitive like me, then you can get it, because we give you the ways in which to get it. So that's good. 25 years later. But the thing is, that's not what interests me. And so the thing is how do I get from the book that needs to get published, that we've been trying to publish, I don't know, for 5 or 10 years, but every time I publish, I go, that's not what I want to tell people. That's not what I want to be known for. But if I don't teach the skills, then the other stuff doesn't seem to work. So that's the cul-de-sac that I've been in. So I think I'm finally out of the cul-de-sac, and I figured out a way to tie the book to the work that we're doing, which is the core idea. That's on purpose. Now, just for those of you that haven't heard me talk about this before, I believe, and it's like the FDA claims on vitamins, you know, when you're being sold stuff, they say there's no therapeutic claim. Well, the only thing I have to show you is that I believe that all the genetics and all the mimetics are there for a reason. And we called them early on when I was talking about emergenic, which is way out there, mimetics. And that has to do with the humaning process of being, doing, having, becoming. That's the first tier. That's probably all you should worry about remembering. Being, doing, having, becoming. That gets that first tier of memes in place because we're all doing those things all the time. It's pretty easy. That's the accepted part of the con. But the thing is, along comes Sapolsky and a whole lot of other people talking about, well, we really don't have free will. So you mean to tell me that I'm behaving the best I can as a result of the best I can with what's in me? Yeah, that's sort of true. Now, there's a few people, and the percentages are so small that they're not even worth mentioning. But when you talk about people that are at the metasystematic level of reasoning and above, AI hasn't got there yet. But when it does, we're in trouble. I can tell you that right now. When we get to the metasystematic reasoning level of reasoning and up, there's only 0.8% of the population. Now, that's a lot of people. Does somebody want to do the math on 0.08 times 8 billion or 7 billion? I know we got somewhere between 7 and 8 billion. I've lost count. That's still quite a few people. But the thing is, for me to run around and say to you, oh, let's go to that state. Let's get to that level. Let's be able to observe ourselves in action and then be able to make changes on the fly, because we have self-awareness about our own purpose. Well, number one, most people don't have enough self-knowledge to know why they're on purpose and why they're not. So they're full of blind spots, as we talked about from the Johari window. And we don't know what we don't know. So until you know some of that, you don't even know you don't know. So that gives us trouble. So going back to this core idea is that we're all on purpose, and it's not our fault, so to speak, which then should say, phew, don't have to worry about that. Okay, now let's find out a little bit about ourselves and find out why we do the things we do. So that's the whole paradigmatic shift. That's a very difficult shift. And that's what I've been struggling with for 30 years once I realized, oh, that's it. And can you do it? Well, I can only do a little bit. You know, obviously those of you who know me know I can only do a little bit of that. So even people who have a dispensation for the awareness of I'm behaving badly in the moment, and to be able to have the tools, skills, wherewithal in place to shift that are very rare. So we're just not going to encounter that. So we all run around and say, oh, well, everybody's choosing to behave badly. That person is not choosing to behave badly. It's probably a combination of who they are, what they think subconsciously they need to, quote unquote, survive. We triggered that survival mechanism, and they're behaving that way because those are the tools that they have. Okay, that's a whole lot different attribution than I've just told you. Then you did that on purpose. And see, this is the whole thing, this whole idea of what do we attribute people's behavior to? And that's, if we don't have free will, then that's just us. So how are we going to check? What's a paradigmatic shift? Because the previous paradigm is saying you have control. You can do it. All you got to do is learn X and Y. All you got to do is follow your guru. All you got to do is follow your teacher. All you got to do is follow the rules. They're saying that to all of us. And then we should behave well. Well, that paradigm is marginally ineffective at this point. And of course, AI is going to show that, because AI looks up and says, well, here's all these patterns and you guys are just unaware of them. Continuing on to validate the purpose of my purpose, that whole idea from consumption to path of purpose. Look, the World Economic Forum annual meeting has concluded. It was a couple weeks ago. Despite a backdrop of complex global challenges, to say the least, delegates descended This was written by McKenzie. I think maybe I didn't give you a resource on this. Sorry. It was by McKenzie. The delegates descended as if they were somewhere on the mount with somebody important from Davos with a renewed sense of possibility. Key themes that emerged, now this is the important part, key things that emerged included the responsible development of AI, which is insane. There's no such thing as responsible development of AI. If you're going to develop AI, you're in trouble. So we're developing AI, we're in trouble. Forget about that, responsible development. We don't even know what AI does. We can't even look inside the black box and predict what AI is going to do most of the time. Proactive risk management and adaptability in the face of disruption. Now, I really like that one, but I don't know how you make that proactive. In other words, that seems more like reactive. In other words, we got to be better at resilience than we are at anti-fragility because we don't know what's going to happen. And that's exactly going to be increased by 100, 200, 1,000, 2 billion fold with AI doing what it's doing. And the need for collaborative, and here's my point, purpose-driven leadership in the 21st century. In other words, here's the thing. If purpose is guiding the decision process, even when we don't have free will, at least we can be aware of why we notice that we're not in line or in alignment with or happy with or whatever, that they don't match up to our values, that they don't do it. At least we can begin to understand that process. And understanding the process and knowing that purposefully it's difficult for us to go along. But on the other hand, most of us don't have UBI yet. So we're going to have to figure out how to monetize at least part of our actions. That's the unfortunate thing about right now. That's why I've said for years, we need a new currency. An artist paints not because they want to sell a painting, mostly. I mean, they do have to do that. They don't have a choice if they want to buy paint and brushes and stuff. And at the same time, they paint because it's in them. Okay, so there needs to be a currency for that. They need to be rewarded for doing what's in them. They're doing purposeful work that we don't have a currency for that. And that when I talk about the failure of capitalism, this is the failure of capitalism in my view. I mean, we really don't have anything better right now. But the thing is capitalism is failing us because it doesn't provide us with a currency with which to make the exchange with people doing what it is that's in them. So we're forcing everybody. It used to be you were forced to farm. Why? Because you had to eat. Then we started doing mechanized stuff, technology came, and it started making it so everybody didn't have to farm. Well, how many people stopped farming? Everybody. There's less than 1% left. And why? Because they still either have a sunk cost in it, they know how to do it, and it's not that big a deal. They might want to do it. There's probably 1% of the people who want to farm, enjoy that stuff. And at the same time, the rest of us don't. Now what do we do? We don't have to do what we had to do because we can eat now because we can go to the grocery store. The grocery store requires money. So can we paint and take a painting into the grocery store and buy eggs? Those eggs that are going to cost you 25% more this year? We grow chickens, so we know about eggs. But I mean, we have chickens that lay eggs, so our egg costs are not going to go up too much. But the point is that we need a new currency. And see that. If I said to you that if the person goes in and trades a painting and gets bread or meat or eggs, well, that's good because the currency allowed for that. But they got to change the painting to money. And money is the currency rather than currency being what's in us. So this is going to take a lot longer. This is why Sapolsky said, yeah, you know, there's no free will. And they said, well, what can we fix this? And he says, yeah, maybe 500 years. So, and it's kind of a long shot. But that's important. That's important to know because some of us changing, and this has always been my point when I got the book at Flow out, the whole point was is to help people begin to see a way that they could change. Because if everybody changes out of growth at the same time, we're all dead. We're all dead. It'll be nothing but fighting over eggs and bread and all that sort of stuff again. So we gotta influence people and organizations as Graves tried to do. Graves' A1N1 statement is the most profound statement of all because no one had made a statement like that before that I ever saw. I'll get you that 1981 summary statement, but you look at A primed N primed, which is yellow in the spiral dynamics world. But he said, look, we're going to have to see things as they are, and we're going to have to adapt our systems, our organizations to that, rather than continually thinking that we're going to make things happen. Because when everybody says, I need a job and I'm willing to do anything, but I don't want to farm, and they come to work, they'll do anything. They'll put cars together. They'll do menial work. They'll, like my grandfather, he scooped out incinerators for $1 a day and spread manure on a farm, cleaning out the pens. That's what he did until he got enough money, and grandma saved enough egg money that they bought him a little shop and he could fix anything. So this is this transition that we're going to make. It's a huge transition. And this is why Musk and a lot of forward-looking people, and I'm not sure about Musk, so don't ask me, but at the same time, he's a very smart person. He said long time ago, before anybody even really knew that the guy knew anything, that we're going to have to do something because people are not going to be able to keep up with the technology. And what are they going to do? Well, from the farm, it was easy. There's thousands of jobs, entrepreneurial and stuff like that, that they can do. But now AI is going to do most everything. Capital is hard to get, and we're making it even harder to get with what we're doing right now. Therefore, you're not going to be able to do what you want to do. You're going to have to do what is available. What's available is AI work. I mean, even when I look for an assistant, the reason I grabbed Micah, I said, maybe I can take Micah, who's a college graduate, and maybe she can learn some of these things that I know I'm going to need to know and we're going to need to have, and maybe she can do that, which she is. She's very bright, and she's able to learn some of these things as we give her time to pick up some of these things. And the new mind, the mind that grew up, just like my kids, Dad, they said to me, Dad, why did you force us to go to computer camp? Because all of our friends were going to baseball camp or volleyball camp or things like that. And I said, the reason was, is I saw what was going to happen, and you needed the computer. And to this day, they say, thank goodness for doing that, because that gave us that period of time where we could monetize our efforts easily. Well, if you're going to monetize your efforts going forward, you're going to have to do it somewhere using AI. In other words, you're going to have to figure that out, because it's the only way. Well, how many of us are going to do that? Not many. I am, but I'm not expecting people to be like me. It's a weird life. So I leave you with that little thought. UBI is coming. It is already here in some forms. It's going to come drastically, though, depending on what happens with Europe. Europe is in big trouble right now. They're the canary in the coal mine. They're going to have to figure it out first. So we'll see what they do. Are we nearing the startup of the formal listen? As we are nearing. Yes, we are. I'm testing the waters in IMAL. IMAL, it's one of my favorite things. It stands for importance, motivation, urgency, leverage, and low-hanging fruit. It's the best five-letter problem-solving model you can find other than the scientific method. Scientific method doesn't have importance in it, just like ITIN doesn't. It's important to get back to the path of purpose and understand individuals as they value action or non-action. Non-action is going to become as valuable as action. In fact, saying no, as I pointed out in 2012 when I released the book At Flow, saying no is just as important as saying yes. So what you say no to is just as important as what you say yes to. Using explanation of the numerator denominator. Okay, what I'm trying to do, I probably need to get a math person to help me with this. I've always had this idea. Let me explain it to you figuratively. I've been trying to work on it. Literally, so that other people can understand it. But here's what happens. Let's assume, and I should put that diagram in the note of the complexity curves. I showed these complexity curves 30 years ago when I started working. I said, look, here's the curves we've been on. Here's the curves that are changing. And now we've got this complexity curve that's nonlinear. So that means complexity is coming at it faster than we can deal with it. If we do that, there's no way we can keep up. Okay, some people, there's about I think maybe a little bigger than 5%. I think there's two basic types, and they have S in them, in the dominant function. One's an internal dominant, one's an external dominant. The ISTJ and the ESTJ, actually the ESTP would be the dominant S on the outside. The ESTJ seems to be the combination like ISTJ, although not a dominant S in the Myers-Briggs. And those two seem to be able to do something. And what that something is limit the growth of complexity that they will accept. In other words, I ran into a significant other in grad school, and they lived a life that showed me that they were not going to allow complexity to dictate their need to keep up with it. They were going to accept only so much. And that's when I realized that I was being turned loose. And they never said any of this stuff. I just had to figure it out afterwards, kind of like the football thing when 25 years after I was playing football, it dawned on me I was in the wrong offense at the end. I did good when I could get back away and see everything. I did not do as well when I was in it and had to make incremental decisions because I'm farthest from the S. S is my inferior function. So you can even use this personality stuff to go back and say, oh, no wonder I didn't do as well as I had done. And this was the reason it had nothing to do with me, yet everything to do with me because I was in the wrong situation. I was in the wrong offense. And this is the same thing. This person says, you know, this is my world. Okay. And I'm going to bound that world. And I'm not going to keep allowing things to come in. I had a client who said, you know, I'm not really big on conspiracy theories. And that's the same type of thing that they were sending a message to me that said, I'm going to bound my world. And I know there's a lot of stuff out there, but I'm not going to buy into that until it becomes real. So I'm going to cut that off. Well, when they do that, they eliminate the need to move as quickly as complexity. People used to be able to move as quickly as complexity, but what you see is a big wagon. Imagine a big wagon, and everybody's going to town, and everybody's on it. And as you go to town, things get more complex, and the people who can keep up with the complexity stay on the wagon, and the ones who can't fall off. Now we've got a wagon where there's one or two people on the wagon, everyone has fallen off, and the one or two people on the wagon says, we can't keep on the wagon very much longer unless we get this. And they got AI. So they get AI doing everything for them so they can extend themselves. But even that means that at some point, those two people will fall off. You see what I'm saying? So in other words, when I talk about the numerator denominator theory, I'm saying, wait a minute, complexity is an open system. This is the mistake that most people make in development. They think higher is better. Higher is not better. What is best is a match between who you are and the situation that you're attracted to. That's best. Not continue, 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 higher, 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 higher. And of course, I tried to make that argument now for 30 years, and it falls on deaf ears because our paradigm says you should try to keep up. Our paradigm says it's a good idea if you know everything. It's a good idea if all that. Well, it's not, because what it causes in the numerator denominator theory, if you let complexity run, you got to run with it. Well, in my case, see, I'm one of those that can't listen to that. So I'm running with it. So I got AI. I got four AIs. Hell with one. And I use them depending on what situation I'm in, and I'm not using them as much as somebody like the people who know how to code. You know, I don't, I should have finished the Fortran class in 1974, but I didn't. I knew it. I knew it, but it was just something that didn't work with my little brain, and it was hard. And, you know, back then you couldn't force me to do anything because I had a football scholarship and school was paid for, so I could take whatever courses I wanted. So nobody said for the football quarterback to take Fortran, but I did. I thought it was cool. It was until it got down to where you had to punch all those cards. And I'm not good at that. I'm not good at any S activities. That's why I got Mike and Gary. They're good at those. They like it.